the work is not going to go away. And only a short-sighted administrator or leader will start cutting back on those people that are so critical to eliminating the risk and assuring the safety from infectious disease. You'd be an idiot to get rid of those people.
Beyond Clean offers a creative look into the inner workings of a healthcare industry committed to getting it right. Every instrument, every time. Join us every week as we explore the hidden world of one of the most important aspects of safe surgical care. And now your hosts, Hank Balch and Justin Poulin.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Dr. Peter Nickel. Dr. Nickel is a minimally invasive pediatric surgeon and developmental biologist. He's done a lot. He's going to be an exciting guest for everybody to listen to this week. I'm looking forward to his insights. If anybody has not read the article that led to his appearing on this episode of Beyond Clean, just look in the show write-up. We'll have a link in there that you can follow. But essentially, he's our first physician that we've interviewed on the show, and he's taken a great interest in sterile processing.
That's right, Justin. If there's one way to get yourself an invite on the show, it is write a viral LinkedIn post that's related to sterile processing and surgical instrumentation. And Dr. Nickel definitely did that. It raised our antenna and had a lot of great interaction online from all over the sphere of perioperative services. So we could not wait to get him in front of our listeners and ask some of these questions that pertain more specifically to the sterile processing world, on how to engage with the challenges, but then also impact these long-lasting solutions that he referenced in the article. So it should be a great show with a fantastic guest.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTracks adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for offsite sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
You're listening to Beyond Clean, the global voice of sterile processing.
Joining us now is Dr. Peter Nickel, Chief Medical Officer of MedAware Systems Incorporated. Dr. Nickel, thank you very much, not only for writing the article that we'll talk about later, but for being our first surgeon guest here on Beyond Clean.
Well, thank you, Justin. So my mother is Dr. Nickel, so I go by Peter, and I believe in a flat hierarchy in the OR. So everybody should be on a first-name basis. The radio should be on the background, and everybody should be loose and relaxed. And if you start calling people doctor and imposing hierarchy, I think it impedes the flow of information. That's a very important cultural aspect to my ORs, and I think more surgeons actually need to embrace that. But so you can call me Peter, okay?
I would be happy to call you Peter, and honestly, I think that that is a refreshing. You're right. That hierarchy thing does impede the flow of communication, and obviously you're focused on total teamwork, and that's really what gets right. A good job done.
Yeah, I mean, healthcare at this point is a multi-level, multidisciplinary process, and I am one part of that process, but I'm completely dependent on all the other people in the OR and actually on the floor to take care of my patients and the residents who participate in all that and the nurses. And if I'm on a first name basis, they're not going to have a problem taking my phone and calling me when there's a problem. So it's important.
It is. And, you know, it's not surprising hearing you say that now, why you took such an interest in sterile processing. And so we'll get to that in segment two, but maybe first introduce yourself to the listeners who may not be familiar. Just give us a little bit of your background and professional bio and how you found MediAware Systems and what the scope and mission of the company is.
Okay, so I'm also an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin in the Department of Surgery, and I'm a pediatric surgeon, and I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. Like I said, my mother's a physician. She's a pediatrician. So I guess the apple didn't fall that far from the tree, and I'm a pediatric surgeon, so very close to the tree. So by way of bio, I mean, I was, to be honest, I was a good, really good college student. I was an average medical student, but always a thinker, and a fairly strong background in the liberal arts coming out of college. I was never a great test taker. I learned to do that, but I would say I was sort of an average medical student, but I also had to get a PhD, and I wound up going into surgery, largely because there's nothing else that truly fit. And when I have residents ask me, medical students say, what should I do with my life, or maybe I want to be a surgeon, I say, if you can love nothing else other than surgery, then that's what you should do, because it's, you know, it is a completely consuming lifestyle. Did my training in Wisconsin and residency and fellowship at Children's Hospital Philadelphia, and I was kind of tooling along as a typical standard young faculty member, the laboratory, and doing a lot of teaching and getting some teaching awards, and blissfully unaware of the processes of the hospital. And I think it was about 2009, my brother-in-law was the COO of a company in Boulder, Colorado, which is still around, called Boulder Imaging. And he asked me to come out and do some consulting to see if there were any medical applications for some really high-resolution cameras they were developing. And during that trip, he said, hey, I got a guy I want you to meet. He's not involved with Boulder Imaging, but he's a good friend of mine. He's a scientist, and I think he's got a really cool idea, and we're going to have breakfast with him. And that guy was Zung Tran, who's a professor of statistics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, or Colorado University or CU or whatever it's called in Boulder. And he went out to breakfast with him, and Zung was a race car driver, and I was a nascent race car driver at that point. And he said, you know, I've got this great idea. He says, you know, I'm a statistician, and Zung published the first meta-analysis. And for those who don't know what meta-analysis is, it's when you take the aggregate of published literature around a specific problem, scientific literature, and you can do this in other, you know, but in biological sciences, you say, I want to look at, say, appendicitis and look at the aggregate data on laparoscopic, which is, you know, minimally invasive surgery versus open, and look at the outcomes. And there's, say, 50 or 100 articles. In meta-analysis, you try to normalize all the data in a one standard data set and then tell you what the preponderance of the data from those, say, 100 articles reveal about open versus laparoscopic surgery and what are the outcomes. So instead of taking one paper, you're looking at all the papers and weighing them all and balancing them and then getting to a statistical weighting of what does the data tell you. So that process is actually very slow the way it's done or it has been done. And most is done through a group called the Cochrane Database, which has been a terrific resource, quite honestly, for healthcare, although it hasn't always been widely accepted. And people have referred to meta-analysis at times as metaphysics. But Zung said, you know, I have an idea to do this at a much higher level in terms of the number of studies at a much higher speed with greater resolution. What do you think about that as a physician? Because Zung was a statistician. I said, I think that's a great idea. And he says, well, I'm thinking about starting a company. I said, well, when you start that company, you let me know, and I'll invest in that company. So in the spring of 2013 or so, I get a phone call. At this point, my brother-in-law has migrated from Boulder Imaging over to work with Zung and two other guys to incorporate MetaWare Systems as a startup. And they called me up, and they said, we need investors. You said you're in 4 years ago. You're still in? I'm like, I'm in. And then I said, great. And by the way, we need a head of our scientific advisory board. Why don't you do that too? I said, okay. and then what happened was that the head of scientific advisory board developed and evolved as a position where I was generating ideas for the company. And I finally said to my brother-in-law, Michael Willis, I said, listen, you know, you need to make me chief medical officer because I'm starting to drive our business ideas and find, you know, ways to apply this technology. And what the technology allows us to do is a meta-analysis about 10,000 to about 100,000 times the speed and depth of any standard meta-analysis that's done by Cochrane now. And we do it with a software assist, but essentially we have a bunch of really, really bright, gifted, I would even argue somewhat on the spectrum people who can go through about two or three articles, published peer-reviewed articles using a software system, extract the data 2 to 3 per hour, and they work 30 to 40 hours a week. So we've linked all these people basically together like a neural net, and they ingest all the data, put it into the database, and then our software, you know, runs the analytics, all this stuff. And then once you have a database built, you can look at this database through a Google-like interface and pick a disease if we have that disease, you know, ingested, and look at the treatment options and even punch in your demographics and see if a specific treatment works for you based on what's in the published literature. So it's much higher resolution than the administrative databases that Medicare and Medicaid have, because those are based on administrative codes that are diagnostic and procedural, but they don't capture the sort of multi-level care that goes on. So that's MetaWare Systems and how I got involved with MetaWare Systems. And now what we're getting into is how, you know, we want to make this accessible to physicians as a clinical decision support tool. We want to democratize it so that it's available to patients on their iPhones and they can link it to their MyCharts on Epic or whatever, you know, EMR they use. And the media market we're getting into right now is in industry, because there's a big, big demand now for these biotech, biodevice companies to present third-party literature when they either certify or they recertify a product to demonstrate that the product is not only safe, but it actually shows improved performance or improved efficacy over what else is out there. So certifying bodies in Europe now are moving towards this model where you get recertified every 3 years, and if you can't show that your device or product isn't more than just a Me Too product and doesn't show improved performance, you will not get recertified. So there's a big demand now in biotech with us. So we've had customers like, SI Bone, Nestle Health, Fresenius KB, Terumo Health. We're working on some stuff for both Medtronic and Stryker. So there's a pretty big demand there, but that's what MetaWare Systems does. Is we're basically trying to take all the hundreds of thousands of articles that are peer-reviewed clinical outcomes research and aggregate them into something that is understandable, digestible, and you can access very, very quickly through an interface.
Peter, this is Hank.
Hi, Hank.
Just so I'm clear on this, then the scope is primarily focus and pointing toward the diagnosis, treatment, disease categories. But they're currently, you mentioned a couple of those companies, you know, that rang a bell, like when you said Medtronic, you know.
Right.
I'm thinking, okay, I have devices that are made by Medtronic in my department, and some of this data that you're talking about out there in those peer-reviewed research journals, like they have applications in sterile processing, and not that I've ever done a meta analysis myself, but I can only imagine trying to get everything that's ever been written about a particular instrument type or sterilization type that's out there and try to make sense of it all. But what you're saying is this system does that on the physician side. Is there application for folks like us in sterile processing that maybe have non-treatment related but still in the circle of care?
Yes. I mean, anything that has been published can be analyzed. And that's really sort of the 1.0 version. I think where we're going to go eventually is a data-driven redesign of EMR that starts capturing this kind of data. And I think how this data gets, you know, brought into the public view is going to probably also change as well. So, you know, right now, for example, Epic, as I understand it, we don't do this at my hospital, but Epic has the ability to spit out a receipt at the end of an operation to tell a surgeon what the disposable costs were. They have that technology now. So I think, you know, it is recordable into EMR or it has been published in the peer review literature, it will get analyzed in the next 5 to 10 years. And I mean, looking at things like, there's interesting stuff around bioburden, right? I mean, so what is bioburden? Well, you know, everybody knows a bone fragment means on an ortho instrument that's been reprocessed. Everybody knows what a hair means, okay? But what about when you have these, you know, UV light detections of these tiny, tiny amounts of bioburden on instruments that aren't visible to the naked eye? And want to know if there's a significant surgical site infection association with that or not. Is that significant or not? You know, that stuff will start. If it hasn't been published, it will get published. We'll be able to aggregate it. And I think the data that will probably be collected with some of the new tracking systems that they're developing in sterile processing, as you know, I mean, and I know, surgeons use maybe, honestly, about 15 to 20% of the instruments that are on their pants. The rest of it's unused, but it's considered contaminated, so it has to be reprocessed. And there's amortization costs with that, and there's, as I outlined in my blog, there's a significant risk to the people washing it because, you know, having handled many more instruments in a shorter period of time. So I think, you know, as we get more data-driven and this stuff starts to see daylight, cleansing sunshine, I think there's going to be a lot of applications and informatics around this that are going to change how we do a lot of things in hospitals. And I think, you know, Medaware is, you know, on the cutting edge of this. I'm certain we'll eventually have competition and other companies are diving into this. But the costs and around these things and the unnecessary costs, as you know, with reprocessing instruments that are never used and the risks that are involved. And there's, you know, these things are reportable, the number of injuries that occur to people reprocessing instruments, the number of instruments they reprocess, and all this can be calculated. That's all reportable data. Interestingly, it doesn't get reported right now. I mean, there's not a lot of data sharing between hospitals around this stuff. There isn't a lot of publication. And I found this out when I took a tour of our own, you know, reprocessing facility. You know, Bob Schuer said, we just don't know what other institutions do because nobody shares this information. But I think we're entering an era where this will be shared, and it'll be like the airline industry sharing safety data because these are real significant safety issues.
Yeah, so if you'll take a step back here and talk to our listeners about how that initial interest on the surgical instrument reprocessing side took place, because I've been in the industry for a number of years, worked with hundreds of surgeons at this point, and a small handful have ever taken any kind of interest to the level that you're talking about right now. What sparked that for you to say, hey, I should probably go down to that engine room and take a look?
The specific situation was that there was an email sent by one of my surgeons that kind of got a non-response from one of my leaders above me about, well, these things happen. We don't know what this means. And I'm like, listen, with bone fragments on an instrument, we all know what this means. This is not, you know, this is not something that I think my words were, if this ever got out, we have a problem and nobody's going to care if you're saying we don't know what this means. Everybody knows what bone fragments mean. And so, you know, I realized that I didn't know a whole lot about this problem. And you know, to be fair, and somewhat self-critical, as physicians and particularly surgeons, we get trained and groomed in a certain way that there's a sense of, I don't want to say quite entitlement, but an above-it-allness to it that we have to actively work to overcome. You know, culturally, we need to break that down. And so the situation prompted this was we had some bioburden issues come up, and I got a response I didn't like. And one of the people, one of the leaders in Repro, reached out to me and said, listen, you know, would you like a tour? And I said, yeah, of course I'd want a tour. I mean, yes, obviously. Oh, my God, where is reprocessing? And they go, well, it's right across from OR1 where you operate. I'm like, what? How did I not know this? And it was just completely humbling. And I remember walking through there. And I'm you know, I was sort of an average medical student, but I'm pretty good at making connections and recognizing patterns. And you know, I think that's not unusual if you do general surgery or you do pediatric surgery. I mean, you encounter stuff that's unusual, and you have to piece things together very quickly in real time. And I you know, within about 5 or 10 minutes of being on a tour, I'm like, okay, first question I have for you. I just stopped at the physician, like, how many pans do you guys process a day? And they're like, well, we process about 200. Okay, how many instruments to a pan? Well, 100 to 150. So I started doing some calculations, and I go, okay, how many people got handling all this? And they give me another number. I'm like, holy crap, they're managing 675 instruments per hour. This is 11 per minute. And I know enough about human performance. I know a little bit about human performance. But I do know that when you start, if you do simple tasks, which mean the same task over and over, every 5 minutes you make an error, right? And if you do a complex task over and over, you make a mistake every 90 seconds, and if it's a complex task under duress, every 30 seconds. This is all stuff that's been worked out by the airline industry when they you know, figure out the limits of human performance of pilots. So I'm you know, extrapolating from that data, going, these people are handling 11 instruments a minute. That's one instrument every 5.5 seconds. None of these instruments look the same. This is insane. This is not a simple task. They are completely stressed out. And that's where, you know, empathy kicks in. And I don't need a whole lot of data at that point to study all this. The next question I'm like, out of my mouth is, okay, so when you guys get these pans back, tell me, what percentage of the instruments do you think are unused? And they're like, 70%. I'm like, really? It's only 70%? I'm like, yeah, it's 70%. Like,
that was okay. An immediate so thought, you know, on your part? Like, this was the first Absolutely. Thing you thought of. That's so interesting.
So can you, I'm trying to think, like, every 5 seconds they're handling an instrument? That's insane. I don't know how they do that. I would probably kill myself. I'd certainly stab myself multiple times by accident, but that's an inordinate amount of stress to put on a human being. Think about that. Okay? So I'm like, okay, so I said, so how many sticks do you guys have a month? I mean, how many times are they getting stuck? I'm like, well, you know, this number. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, okay, so I don't need any more data here. We need to, like, clamp down the number of instruments and pants. I mean, you know, we can all do hernias with, you know, 6 or 7 instruments. We can all do laparoscopic appendectomies with 6 or 7 instruments. We can all do anti-reflux operations in kids with about, you know, 15 instruments or, you know, we don't need that many instruments. And so, you know, surgeons think they need stuff or they might need stuff, so they sort of do the, you know, let's prepare for the nuclear winter and have everything in the cellar sort of attitude. but in point of fact, they don't need most of those things. So I started looking at my own pans after that, and I realized I was using about 14 to 15% of my instruments. Anyway, so, you know, and then I asked them, well, okay, so this is, I'm getting ahead of myself, but my next question was, well, so what's your turnover here with these poor people who are working this hard? You know, like, well, you know, if we can retain somebody for 6 months, that's great. I'm like, okay, so you have to train them. And then they leave after 6 months, and they're like, yep. I'm like, okay, well, I know why they're leaving. All right. But I mean, in terms of stress on the job, what percentage of them are doing overtime? Oh, we all do overtime. You all do overtime. Yeah. Okay. And are you doing overtime on days? Oh, yeah, we do days and weekends. Like, all right. Okay. So, I mean, all of this, I'm thinking, all right, so I can't believe that we're subjecting humans to this kind of work. And it's important, though. I mean, you can't – there's no technological substitute for good
right.
conscientiousness.
Critical thinking okay? and just, being able to make critical observation, no doubt.
Right, right, right. And somebody can just stop the assembly line and say, hey, we got a problem, right, because the machine can't do that. But, you know, I came out of that, and I was all fired up. And it took me about – it wasn't even a day, and I just said – you know, I sent out an email saying, look – we have a real problem, and the real problem is we have too many instruments. Like that's the zero cost, simple. You know, we can expand the reprocessing area. We can get more washers, and we can get more sterilizers. But what we really need to do is we need to reduce all the instruments we don't use. And there's heat fatigue on metal. You know, putting them through the autoclaves and all this other stuff, and instruments break. You know, and but beyond all that. Why are we subjecting these people to this unnecessary work? Why are we stressing them like this? Because this is complex work at a very, very, you know, high rate of speed that they have to do all this. And in fact, they're in terms of human performance, they're outperforming the averages because their error rate was about 3.4% for bioburden. However they measure that, that's what they told me. But, you know, if that's over 5 minutes, right? 3.4%, that's actually pretty good, but they should be making an error actually every 30 seconds, right? So that means one in every six instruments actually should have a flaw in it based on the volume that you're pushing through there, the stress in the system, that it's a complex system, that you're a complex series of tasks that you're trying to execute. There are, you know, so one in six, so that's what, you know, 16%, right? So they're actually overperforming, but the turnover rate is so high, and you can't maintain a culture of continuous improvement and safety if you got people leaving every 6 months. I mean, it just doesn't work. So, you know, I got all fired up about this, and my group, my pediatric surgery group, is very amenable to all this, and we tend to standardize how we approach specific cases. And so I went to them and I said, listen, you know, here are the numbers, guys. And I counted on the instruments I used for a week, and it's 14 to 15%. And since we all sort of do these 7 or 8 cases the same way, it's going to be the same for you guys. And they're like, yep, you're right. Let's meet with the service line leaders and let's start reducing our PANs now. Let's start doing it. So we're now into that process.
Well, for probably the first time in a while, you're actually preaching to the choir here on this show. And I think everybody out there is going to find your interest level, engagement, and the fact that you're continuing the discussion to be very refreshing, especially for the individuals who didn't pull the parachute at the 6 month mark and have continued to make a lifelong profession in sterile processing. And I want to get into more of this in the second segment because you alluded to a lot of your article. We're going to dive into that, but I also want to bring the other side of the coin to the folks working in sterile processing. I want to bring the viewpoint of what the impact of instruments that are not in good quality to them when we start off segment two. So we'll be right back after a short break. We We're back with Peter Nickel, Chief Medical Officer of MedAware Systems Incorporated. And Peter, kind of set the table as we close segment one, but I do want to talk about the flip side to that coin, which is the impact of instrument issues when they reach the OR, such as poor functionality or maybe that bone, that bioburden that you talked about, missing instruments. I think we know patient outcomes are tied directly to how long they're going to be under anesthesia and how much blood loss has occurred during the case. And I just want to make sure for all the sterile processing technicians and leaders that are listening to the podcast today that they kind of get your feel for that or what that looks like in the OR since you're there with the patient right in front of you.
So give me the scenario again. So, or give me the question again. So I'm in the OR. The instruments are there, and the question is in terms of functioning instruments or instruments malfunctioning or breaking
down? Really
down
both. Really both. If there's a malfunctioning instrument or if you find one that has bioburden, what does that look like?
Yeah.
What's the response? And then how much, really, I'm saying, added time to the case? That's where the inefficiency piece comes in.
Yeah, I mean, if they find bioburden and it's hit the back table with all the other instruments, guess what? You got to break down and reset up. So that adds, 15, 20 minutes, and that's assuming you have the pans you need. Unfortunately, historically and up until recently, those pans have 100-plus instruments, and they've got to be counted, and so it adds a significant delay. Obviously, the answer I alluded to earlier is we need to make much smaller pans with only the instruments we need for that specific case. And I've argued since this whole thing started, I've argued, well, you can always have a rescue pan in the sterile core, if you need other stuff that you can break into if you need it. But 95% of the time, you're not going to need it. So let's just keep it in the sterile core available. So if it's when you get bioburden and you haven't started the case or you find it, you got to break stuff down and start over. Having the middle of the case, I don't know what you do at that point. I mean, I think you probably open up another set of instruments. I've not been in that situation. I have had the instruments that are, worn down. Typically it's scissors or laparoscopic scissors. And then we have occasional laparoscopic grasp or, there are these long, skinny, slender instruments with these delicate handles and these small tips on them. And because of heat fatigue every now and then, one of those ends will snap off. But most of the malfunctions have to do with just not having sharp enough surgical scissors or laparoscopic scissors. But it's a big deal when you have a bioburden show up. And we found all kinds of interesting stuff. Some of it actually has to do with a lack of awareness. I mean, it isn't just on the instruments, but the linens, right? So we still use linens most of the time, not on a patient, but on the back tables. I haven't gone there yet, but Madison Union Hospital Laundry that reprocesses all our stuff also is under the same kind of duress and does an outstanding job taking care of us. But we found out all kinds of interesting things about what happens to linens when they get reprocessed. And they find tons of hair. They found an arm board. They found an iPad. They found, when you write on hospital gowns with those pens or any of those towels, that stuff has to be disposed of because you never get the ink out, so it's no longer considered sterile. So those things all slow down the efficiency of the OR, and, they certainly cause a lot of anxiety for the surgeons and for the team because you're trying to take care of this patient, and now you're wondering what other risks you are subjecting them to. And then, people under these circumstances, when they have these surprises, go to the darkest part of their mind and start thinking about, the cases you've heard about, the one-offs of the colonoscope that wasn't reprocessed after being in a hepatitis C or an HIV patient that then somebody got scoped with. I mean, this is where your mind goes to. So it causes a fair amount of anxiety, It's a bad thing when it happens.
The other thing we talked about off air that I want to make sure we bring to the listeners and to the podcast today was I think we teed it up talking about how many OR nurses and scrub techs do any kind of rotation or orientation to sterile processing and then vice versa. I would say it's highly recommended, but I liked your take about generating empathy and some of the other benefits of that. Maybe we talk about that a little bit as well, because I think you started off saying that really healthcare in many ways operates in silos.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so my hospital, like a lot of hospitals, is going through a budget crunch right now, and we're starting to flex people. So in our pre-operative, post-operative space, those nurses are in pre-op when everything's quiet and over to post-op. So getting people to get out of their comfort zone, their traditional roles, and grow. And so they become more knowledgeable of different spaces and how things work over there. So when this happens, you force people to do this sort of stuff. The people who choose to stick around get engaged and end up learning what the other spaces are doing. And now they start developing empathy for those spaces about what's going on and why there may be delays and how can I help rather than complaining about it. But, you know, the whole concept of empathy is very much linked to knowledge. It's integral to the whole concept of teamwork, right? And ORs are teams. And they're very high functioning teams and under a lot of stress. I've often told people that, you know, surgeons are essentially high performance athletes because we stand there doing yoga postures for 8 hours operating on patients. But none of that really works unless you have everybody sort of pulling in the same direction. And empathy is really critical to that. And honestly, in some ways, it sounds crazy, but so is love. Great athletic teams, when you talk about, for example, the Green Bay Packers of Vince Lombardi's here. You know, those guys were all a band of brothers. There was a deep love amongst them. The great Soviet hockey teams, there was a deep love amongst those players. You have to have that sort of empathy, that sort of deep caring for your teammates, and whether you can see them or not. And with that comes the understanding of how the system works. And if you understand how the system works, then you can start, when you're confronted with problems and challenges and as things evolve, you're much more facile at coming up or helping other people come up with solutions rather than just getting mad and, venting about it. And we've all seen bad behavior in the OR. We know how people act when they get frustrated. But empathy is really critical. And, I don't think they rotate our nurses that they're training through sterile processing. I don't think they rotate our surgical techs through there. I think they do know the location of the central sterile processing in our hospital, but I don't think they have necessarily a deep understanding of how that works. That doesn't mean they don't want to do that. They just are not given that opportunity, or maybe they're not thought about that.
Talking about the teamwork perspective across those teams between the OR and sterile processing, one of the nice things just architecturally in your facility, it sounds like, is the sterile processing team is close at hand. In the industry, it is very, very common for the SPD department to be on a completely different floor, oftentimes the basement. And so there's that physical separation that you don't see each other. You're not going to the same break room. You're not in the same locker room. There's not that band of brotherhood that you were referencing there. So when these quality challenges come up, the temptation or the natural inclination is not to, okay, let's all get together and solve this together. It's the he said, she said, it's their fault, kind of challenge and response. And so I just say in designing the layouts even of our operating rooms, it can make more sense if you're keyed into this kind of conversation to say, where are we going to put this team that's such a central part of quality in our surgical program? Are we going to separate them by buildings or floors or not? So just wanted to bring that up. But
So that's a great point. So, I think we could all take a lesson from what, is happening in Silicon Valley as well as Nestle Health, where they're going to this much more open format of offices. Like, I think hospitals could stand a redesign that way. And I think there's a couple other variables you have to consider, which is the specific environment you're talking about. So, like, clinic flows are different than OR flows, right? But visibility and transparency are really critical to, you know, trust and empathy. And you're right. I mean, getting people to mix together and having more collisions between people where they're talking to each other is going to result in better team dynamics. It will result in team dynamics, which may not exist, in better team dynamics, and ultimately better problem solving, right? I mean, this gets back to lean principles, right? I mean, you know, ideas will start percolating up because you're having cross-pollinization across multiple disciplines that otherwise would not be interacting with each other. So, I mean, I think the real answer is maybe we really need to rethink OR design so that we're not just doing the best for the patients in the moment, but we're thinking about the whole process of how we do better for the patients. Did they get wiped down before they went back? Did they have the right core temperature when they go to sleep? They got their antibiotics, but, you know, are we empathetic to everything that's going on around us so that we really look in the whole ecosystem of the ORs and allowing us to harness the potential, the human potential that's there so that it can perform optimally? And I don't think, clearly, we're not doing that. When you're talking about, you know, sterile repro being like four floors down in the basement, which looks like a dungeon, low ceilings and no windows, you know, no doubt why people want to leave that for 6 months, right? And it's like working in a dungeon. It's terrible.
So we've been talking a lot about specifics on your article here, but I want to make sure to get the name of it out there since that's actually what prompted this whole interview. And I know that many of our listeners will want to go read the actual article itself. It was called Occam's Razor and the OR, the Simplest Solution for Reducing Bioburden on Surgical Tools. And, of course, we'll make sure to include that link on our show notes so folks can find it there. But in particular, I wanted to get your perspective on a question that's hiding in the background of all of this. One of the major points in your article was that the technicians that you observed did not have enough time to adequately inspect the instruments that they were processing, specifically because of the huge percentage of wasted instruments in the trays. However, if the surgical team does what you're proposing and reduces the wasted instruments, what's to stop administrators from seeing that as an opportunity to reduce staffing in the SPD?
Well, as I'm fond of saying, there's no good substitution for a good conscientious human being, right? And so we implement these changes. But if we need that to happen and we bring those numbers down, right, and our efficiencies improve, so we're supposed to have another 3 billion people added to the world in the next 30 years. I can't imagine that the rate of surgical disease is actually going to disappear. And simply because we become more efficient, I don't think the work is going to go away. I think we will solve this particular problem. This is the really nice thing about it is it's sort of zero cost. And I like that because you don't have to take money away from the system to fix it. You actually will eliminate waste and improve the value within the system. But we'll fix this and we're going to move on. There's going to be other problems to solve. And I think the worst thing you can do if you're an administrator and you're sort of imbued with a sense of the quarterly corporate bottom line is actually worry about the corporate bottom line, because the next problem that needs to be solved is going to be identified, and likely the solution is going to rise up from somebody, you know, who's at the ground level on the battlefield and brings that problem forward. And the healthcare systems are going to have to move towards this lean structure where you can sort of crowdsource the problem solving locally to address these issues. So, you know, we'll fix this, and there's going to be other issues that are going to come up. And you know, there's no sort of real artificial intelligence out there that's going to fix that. There's no sort of technology that's going to anticipate those things. That comes from having zested human beings who care about this stuff. And, I know there's always that fear, and certainly with what's going on in the country with budget cuts to healthcare systems, that's I don't want to say legitimate concern. It's a very reasonable fear to have, right? But if you think about what happens when We take the human beings out of this. And that sort of key point of view, and then we can't pick up on these other problems to solve. And then we start having problems with, you know, bioburden again, and then it only takes one lawsuit and one newspaper to get a hold of something to completely take out a whole hospital system, bring JCO in, and shut everything down. So I know there's that concern, but I think there's just too many problems to solve. We need good people to solve them. I mean, the problem we have now is we can't keep people because they keep leaving. And they're all doing overtime. We're burning them out. We need to pay them better. We need to give them better working conditions. We need to give them, you know, we need to put them in positions where they're not going to have an error rate of 3.4%. We need to act, you know, and if they had told me 7 or 8 years ago, look, our biggest stressor is the 70% of stuff that comes back is unused. Can you get rid of this? This would make our lives better. You know, if we had more of an open format in terms of how our ORs are designed and engineered, I'd have been all ears. I would hope. Yeah. So I don't think the jobs are going to go away. I really don't. And, I mean, as we're getting older and more complex as patients in this country and the population is going up, I mean, there's so many challenges. There's just so many challenges. And bright people who, you know, are ambitious and want to work hard, and medicine's becoming more and more multidisciplinary, there's going to be jobs for those people. There's no doubt about it. No doubt. What I worry about is we're treating them so poorly now because of the siloing and because of the stresses we put on them and the lack of engagement, is the turnout rate's enormous. They won't stay with us. They'll go and move on to some other job. They're like, I don't want this, even though it's one of the most critical jobs in the whole hospital. That and the people, the custodial staff who keep the hospital clean. Oh, my God. I mean, that's, you know, infectious disease 101.
Yeah, so, and, you know, going back to the work that you're doing with MedAware, I'm thinking, okay, we reduce waste and instrument trays. What are we going to do with that extra time? And you're right. The time will be spent on other challenges that are already in the workflow but are being drowned out just to keep up with the volume. And, you know, even this past week, we've been tooling around with some new microscopes in our facility to look at some of these micro instruments. And I have been absolutely amazed to see what the tips of some of these forceps actually look like under enhanced magnification. Another opportunity even out there is tackling the complexities in the processing instructions. And I can't remember if that was in your article or not. I know you talked about the sharps risks and such, but just not only inspecting and looking at everything with a critical eye, but also following the manufacturer's specific recommendations for how long you're soaking, how many times you're brushing, what kind of brushes you're actually brushing with. Is this being run on the right cycle in a proper container or packaging system? There's a lot of confusion and ignorance out there on the part of the entire perioperative team, you know, but the responsibility ends up on the shoulders of these sterile processing professionals. And oftentimes the compromise is made just because there's not enough time to ask those critical questions. So well, I am super excited about this proposal.
Well, and this gets back to, you know, how you design your ORs. But one thing I asked, and the other thing I can tell you, is I asked Bob Schuler, I said, listen, I want a list from your techs of what the most difficult stuff is to reprocess. And that is a fundamental question that we need to be asking every time we do a capital purchase. Every single time. And the next question you'd be asking is, what else could a surgeon use that doesn't take so much time to reprocess? So, of course, I don't know if you saw my other blog, but I'm not a fan of the robot, okay? It's a solution looking for a problem, in my opinion. But what they, you know, we've got great techs in repro, but it takes them a good, like, 4.5 hours or something to reprocess the robot. And we've got two robots, you know. So, you know, on top of all the other things with the robot, which is a $2.5 million acquisition with $154,000 a year of just maintenance, and then after 10 uses, every single, you know, attachment needs to be replaced for $30,000 a shot. And then on top of this, you know, I have to basically take one tech and put them out for 4.5 hours to reprocess one piece of equipment, which does not show a superior outcome to anything we do laparoscopically. And I said to Bob Shore about this, because, you know, he oversees the repro. I said, did they talk to you when they purchased the robot about this? He's like, no, they just bought the thing. And they just told us they had to figure it out. We had zero input. I said, that is insane. That is wrong. I mean, you know, you need to be asked these questions of what is the labor burden to get this stuff clean if we're going to use it safely. And if it's this excessive, we shouldn't be purchasing it. That should be true of every piece of equipment.
But nobody knows how to quantify that labor burden. It's so interesting, but they consider that to be a soft savings. And it's actually from another quote in the article. You say that the other downstream benefit is that if there are fewer instruments to gather and spray at the end of the case, you will spend less time turning over the OR, which means less time to get the next patient into the room for the next case. And that right there, the OR is a revenue generator, so people pay so much attention to that. But that human resource that you're describing is so difficult to quantify. And it actually leads to the previous question, which was, once we quantify it, will they just reduce the human resources and the problem remains?
No, because what's going to happen is, you know, the OR times will decrease. We're still going to be doing more cases, right? I mean, this is all going to be about lean and trying to get as much done during prime hours as we possibly can get done. So I'm not going to be able to reduce it. You know, I'd love to get it down to when they're doing two instruments, you know, a minute, okay? I'm not sure it's going to get that low, but it will go lower. But again, we are outstripping our labor capacity right now because we're paying so much for overtime, right? That's not sustainable, and it's burning people out. I mean, we aren't even close to the equilibrium. So I hear what you're saying, but I don't think you're going to be cutting back on this part of the labor force because it's too critical to delivering a safe outcome. And it's also integral to how an OR runs optimal. And yeah, those, you can call them soft costs, but we're talking about, you know, one OR a minute is $106 of capacity. It is unused, right? If I'm, you know, I have longer OR times, I don't have good first starts, it's taking longer for things to be processed. And if I start pushing out in the overtime to get things done, that I can get done within prime hours, okay? You know, my costs are double for overcapacity than what they are for undercapacity. And what we're headed towards in this medical economic environment is overcapacity. It's coming. I mean, you know, there's going to be less reimbursement. Hospitals now do more volume, they do it more efficiently, and get better outcomes. The work is not going to go away. And only a short-sighted administrator or leader will start cutting back on those people that are so critical to eliminating the risk and assuring safety from infectious disease. You'd be an idiot to get rid of those people. It's terrible. You would not do that, okay? There's a lot of things you can cut before you cut that. That's all. I mean, you're getting rid of the engineers on the ship when you do that. Then nobody can run the boats. The boat won't steer. It won't have any forward drive. Drive shafts will be shut down. The engine will be shut off. If you can't run the ORs, you can't run them safely. And God help you, if you have a biobird issue, and all of a sudden you have either the press coming in to look at this or you have JACO coming in, because then you're in deep trouble. I mean, they might shut down the whole hospital, right? So they can't afford to do that. They can't. And I understand the worry and the concerns in this environment we're in economically, but, you know, I think the real answer is the stuff we talked about, which is you build a much more open, transparent culture. You know, we think about this stuff when we build hospitals going forward, and we think about empathetically about the struggles other people are going through to get this stuff to us and what the burden is on those people, the stress, and what the impact that is on our patients. And when we ask ourselves those questions, we step back and go, wait a second. No. We got to worry about the human beings here. We cannot be simply about profits. We need to be fiduciary in our thinking. We got to take care of our people. We got to take care of our product, which is our healthcare, right? And we don't have to worry about investors because most of us are not for profit. So we need to take care of those two groups of people, our patients and and the people that really work hard to deliver the best care possible. And it isn't, you know, what we have to understand here is that sterile processing is part of patient care.
You're an incredible guest. I'm just going to warn you right now. I can already see the requests for speaking engagements at regional Isham chapter meetings, their annual meetings, rolling in, honestly, because you have a passion, not only for sterile processing, and maybe that was newfound, but I would say just for healthy culture in general. And those are the kinds of speaking engagements that people, you know, when they take time on their Saturday, when they finally get a break, if they're not working overtime, and go and engage in a learning event, they want to also be inspired. And, you know, I would say that your passion for the business, and specifically their business in sterile processing, you're probably going to get a few requests. I'm just going to give you a heads up.
That'd be great. I love to meet people and I want to hear what they have to say. And, you know, we should be sharing this knowledge, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. Like, we got to be helping people.
Amen. That was Peter Nickel, pediatric surgeon and chief medical officer of MediWare Systems Incorporated. Hank, the article was fantastic, but having the opportunity to speak with Peter was even better.
So during the breaks there, Justin, I actually started creating a T-shirt with his face on it for every sterile processing tech in the country to start wearing to work, saying there are surgeons out there who support us, believe in our mission for safe patient care, and understand the complexity of our jobs. And I know there's many more of them out there, but we have not had the opportunity yet to get one on the air with us. And what a terrific perspective, insight. Of course, we talked about a lot of the solutions, you know, but just understanding the challenges themselves as well. I had a fantastic time.
Yeah, I did too. And I think one of the things that he set the table with, and I don't want to use the word humble or humility, because right out of the gate, he said, call me by Peter, first name basis only. And his point about hierarchy creating an environment with decreased communication, I think, was really important. And I know when we got into segment two, we talked a little bit about silos and empathy, but you know, it makes a very good statistical argument for reducing instruments in the containers and how that would improve patient care. But he also has like this real focus, this human focus on making the jobs more reasonable and getting that 4% rate of bioburden down more attainable. And that's a real big picture thinker. And I think that's what I enjoyed the most, was the fact that not only is he a numbers guy, but he's very much in tune with the human element as well.
Yeah, the connection between quality and the volume there was something that I had not seen a connection with in an article like that that he has published, where you're saying, how do you decrease bioburden? Typically, the answers you hear are, well, you need to pay more attention. You need to focus on pre-cleaning in the OR. You need to make sure that you have the right brushes and equipment and decontamination. That's where the focus is. Well, he threw a curveball and said, no, all that's important, but that's not the first place to start. The first place to start is get rid of all this waste in the flow and free yourself up to then focus on all of those quality steps it's going to take to get it right. And hearing that from anyone's perspective, but especially from that surgical perspective, is very encouraging for a sterile processing leader, and hopefully it will be for the administrators and OR leaders who listen to this show.
Well, I just feel like the industry is begging for a voice like this to help characterize that soft cost. I mean, he handled that question really, really well, and I think it is something that, while it is difficult to quantify, is an important consideration in trying to develop efficient practices in sterile processing.
And I'm going to throw it out there. Anytime anyone wants to do some meta analysis of these IFUs, let's make it happen. We'll get Peter back on the show and have that conversation.
That's excellent. Well, I think that's a great way to end the show. I don't know how far you're going to get with that one, at least not on a volunteer basis.
There you go, yeah.
That's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes and Stitcher. We'd certainly appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to Hank and myself. And on behalf of both of us, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.